Public Service Commission is moving forward with a rule that may hurt small renewable energy producers. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck, and Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition.
We'll also tell you about a groundbreaking for a new homeless shelter in Missoula. And in our feature interview, reporter Edward O'Brien talks with two individuals working to improve health care for transgendered people. The Montana Public Service Commission is enacting a rule that may hurt the ability of small renewable energy projects to sell their power. Commissioners voted 4-1 to approve changes in which facilities can apply for what are called standard offer contracts from a utility. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce says commissioners believe the new rule will be good for ratepayers.
I'll explain these standard offer contracts first. They pretty much say if a small power generator, like a family-owned wind farm, can be built and can get its power to a regulated utility for the same price it would take the utility to create that amount of new power, the utility has to buy the small project's power. It's supposed to spur more renewable energy development. Right now, the facilities qualifying for these special contracts can be up to 10 megawatts in size. To compare that, the Colstrip coal-fired plant can generate up to nearly 2,100 megawatts. The Kerr Dam, southwest of Polson, generates nearly 200 megawatts. So 10 megawatts is not too big. But starting November 14th, that level is going to drop from 10 megawatts down to 3 megawatts. Jeff Fox is the Montana Policy Manager for the Renewable Northwest Project. He says dropping the level for which facilities qualify down that low will make it uneconomical for new small power producers to get into the industry.
Maybe some small hydro projects will be able to make it, but most projects will be ineligible.
Small power producers formally requested the Public Service Commission not approve the lowering of the standard offer contract size. Billings engineer Scott Aspenlider was just hoping the commission would delay the rule's effective date. He's been working for about 5 years as a partner in a company trying to build a hydroelectric power facility below Canyon Ferry Dam.
It's going to be somewhere between 5 and 10 megawatts.
Aspenlider says his company is close to securing a deal with Northwestern Energy on the project and is worried if that deal doesn't happen in the next 2 weeks, it might not happen at all.
We now kind of fall into no man's land as far as where we can go with our project to complete it.
Is it really the responsibility of the ratepayers across Montana to pick up the increased cost just because they cannot compete on an open contract market?
That's Public Service Commissioner Bob Lake. See, without the standard offer contracts, these small power producers have to enter a competitive bidding process with the utility. If some other provider can get that power to the utility cheaper, then the utility goes with that provider, whether it's a large power plant upping their production a little bit, or maybe some power generator in a neighboring state.
That's just kind of simple economics.
Northwestern Energy spokesman Butch Larcombe.
I guess I don't think that, you know, we're acting against anybody's interests except maybe the handful of developers of some of those projects.
Larcombe says the utility has a responsibility to seek the lowest cost power possible. But he says casting Northwestern as being anti-renewable energy is not accurate. Northwestern is seeking approval from the Public Service Commission to purchase PPL Montana's hydroelectric dams. Larcombe says if that purchase goes through, more than 50% of the utility's power generation will come from renewable sources. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
And the Montana Public Service Commission has decided to look for a consultant to help it evaluate whether Northwestern Energy's proposed purchase of 11 hydroelectric dams from PPL Montana is a good deal for its customers. Northwestern announced last month it planned to buy the dams for $900 million to provide power for its Montana electric customers at steady prices. The purchase price would be passed on to ratepayers and must be approved by several regulators, including the PSC. Lee Newspapers of Montana reports commissioners agreed with a staff recommendation yesterday to look into hiring a consultant who is more familiar with the software being used to compare the long-term costs of buying the dams against the costs if Northwestern Energy continued to buy power from other companies. Northwestern expects rate to increase by 5% with the dam purchases.
And in other news from around the state, Montana State University police are investigating a rape reported in one of the dorm rooms. MSU sent an email to students, faculty, and staff last night notifying them of an alleged rape on Monday. The notice says university police were called to Bozeman Deaconess Hospital Monday night, where a woman said she had been spending time in the room of a man she knew when he sexually assaulted her early Saturday. MSU was required to send the alert under federal law. MSU also alerted students in September to rapes reported at separate fraternities early on September 15th.
Officials have released the name of a 19-year-old Big Fork man who died in a single vehicle rollover on Montana Highway 83 north of Condon. The Montana Highway Patrol tells the Daily Interlake that Matthew James Edwards was returning from a successful elk hunting trip when he drifted off the highway, overcorrected, and rolled his pickup. The crash was reported at about 8:30 a.m. Monday. Big Fork football coach Todd Emsley says Edwards graduated from Big Fork High last spring, where he played football. He was the homecoming king last fall.
A state senator and Blackfeet tribal council member says he plans to ask a judge to drop federal charges against him after he pleaded guilty in tribal court to similar charges of fleeing a sheriff's deputy on the reservation. Senator Shannon Ogier spoke publicly yesterday for the first time since the May 26th traffic stop that led to drunken driving, reckless driving, and obstruction charges being filed against him. The Browning Democrat apologized for his behavior. He also defended his failed attempt to dismiss the federal charges as an intrusion into tribal sovereignty. After U.S. Magistrate Judge Keith Strong rejected Ogier's argument that federal prosecutors lacked jurisdiction, the Blackfeet leader pleaded guilty to similar charges in tribal court. Ogier says he will again ask Strong to dismiss the federal charges.
A fugitive from Montana is behind bars after being found working at a ranch in Powell. The Park County Sheriff's Office says 57-year-old Gary Henson of Great Falls, Montana, was apprehended yesterday afternoon. Henson ran when deputies asked the ranch, and they chased him for over a mile. At one point, deputies said he stopped and held a knife to his chest, but later told them he never intended to take his own life. Henson is described as a transient and wanted in Montana's Cascade County for sexual assault and obstructing a police officer. He's being held in the Park County Jail and is due to appear in court tomorrow morning.
Missoula's Pavarello Center broke ground on its new facility on West Broadway today, and officials hope to move in by the end of next year. The center's executive director, Aaron Fowler-Pahan, says the $4.7 million shelter and soup kitchen will provide more space and more services.
One of the most exciting things for us is the new facility will provide us the space to do things like offer GED classes for people staying with us, do some vocational training in our commercial kitchen, really just provide people access to the resources they need to move out of homelessness.
Funding for the new POV is a combination of local and federal, public and private money. A local committee has raised $1.3 million of private money so far and hope to raise another $300,000 in the next few months. The new facility will be able to house 100 people.
We will have a bed for each of those, which is exciting. Right now, about 40 people stay on the floor every night. And then we'll have some really creative multiple-use spaces like classrooms and dining halls, which could accommodate an increase in need for an emergency, some kind of a weather event. But we're really designing a building to serve the need today.
Some neighbors complained about the new facility being located at the old Trails End site. Pan says they will do their best to earn the community's support.
The Pavarello Center was founded by community members and really belongs to the Missoula community. So it's important for us to always be listening, not just to our adjacent neighbors, but to everybody in Missoula about what they want, how they see the Pavarello Center operating in Missoula, and to make sure that we're being accountable to that. So we're really excited to work alongside the neighbors. We're looking at initiating an advisory council where the neighbors can let us know how we're doing and bring new ideas and programming ideas to us. And we really see it being a relationship that is going to be long-term in how we operate the POV moving forward.
The new shelter is being built by the Montana-based Swank Enterprises with a focus on sustainability and energy efficiency.
A state fire marshal is investigating a fire that damaged an outbuilding at the Montana State Prison in Deer Lodge. Prison spokeswoman Linda Mundry says the fire started about 4:30 p.m. yesterday in the Equipment Maintenance Services building. The building is used to store farm implements and equipment. Prison staff and fire departments from the Deer Lodge and Racetrack fought the blaze.
The transgendered have unique healthcare needs that can be challenging for both the patient and, in many cases, the physician. A first-of-its-kind for Montana healthcare conference held last week in Missoula drew over 100 participants from around the country. Last week's gender expansion conference included medical and mental health care professionals, transgendered individuals, their parents, and advocates. The conference was sponsored by Missoula's Blue Mountain Clinic with assistance from the Pride Foundation and the Gender Expansion Project. In this evening's feature interview, Blue Mountain's Lindsay Burke and conference participant Aaron Armstrong discussed the sometimes complicated healthcare and personal issues facing the transgendered. First, Lindsay explains the difference between sex and gender.
Sex is biological, and generally there's two categories there, male or female, which has provided some difficulties for a lot of folks who were born with more ambiguous genitalia that isn't easily recognizable from a more biological sense as either male or female. So I guess you could say that maybe there's three sexes. Gender is more of the performance of sexuality, of expression within a society. Just because someone is maybe has one certain biological sex, their gender expression will be very different. And we all exist somewhere on a spectrum of our own individualized combinations of masculinities and femininities that we all possess. And so while someone could look a certain way and present a certain way that reads symbolically to certain cultural social cues, inside they might be very different.
Lindsay, it sounds complicated sometimes.
It is. You really opened a can of worms with that question. But I see transgender folks as gender radicals. They're on the extreme of the gender spectrum, and transgender people prefer to be living in a body that's sexed differently from how they were born.
The conference here is about healthcare issues.
Mm-hmm. So the biggest issue there is access. Knowledge about transgender from a medical perspective has really been ramped up, I would say, in the last 20 years. But that's mainly been in urban centers, in the Seattles, in the San Franciscos, in the LAs, in the New Yorks. So in more rural locations, such as Montana, access to good medical care has been in a deficit. Now, what's happened over the last 10 or so years is increasing numbers of providers have been providing hormone replacement therapy for their patients, patients that they've had that then went on to request this and they felt comfortable with that patient, so they just started doing it. But there's been very little research on the effects of hormones on transgender folks. So the majority of the research has been primarily around the effects of hormone replacement therapies for postmenopausal women. So in that, there's a lot of barriers to accessing information and accessing really good care. The main mission of this conference is to provide training on more advanced topics within transgender care, such as younger folks, teens before they hit puberty, to block puberty from happening and allow them to transition into the gender expression identity and even potentially biological sex that they wish to be, that they feel that they are. And also older folks. There's less information on elderly people and how transitioning can affect their bodies. Also post-operative care. How do you take care of someone after they've had a gender reassignment surgery? The knowledge just is not here in Montana. By bringing in doctors who are at the top of their field nationwide here to Montana to train our local docs on these concepts, we'll later on provide more access to folks living in Great Falls.
How many people are seeking out this care?
Well, from our approximations, we believe that there's around 850 to 1,000 trans-identified individuals in Missoula County alone.
How do you figure that?
That was done literally by doing extensive field work, but it wasn't easy because there aren't statewide stats on that. So it was a lot of calling around. The other thing is, there's no way to know for sure if all of those folks are actually seeking care. There's a lot of issues in the transgender community around insurance and finances that make it even more difficult to access care that they need.
Speaking of, what about the Affordable Care Act? Are any of these issues covered under that?
Is trans covered under the Affordable Care Act? Do you know?
So my name is Aaron Armstrong. I'm here from San Francisco as a special guest for the conference. So under the Affordable Care Act, there are several different things happening that affect trans individuals. A lot of the insurance that is being provided through the exchanges is trans-inclusive. And then there's also been a movement at the state level that's supported by the Affordable Care Act to strip away the anti-trans clauses. So, like, for example, a lot of insurance companies right now will have a specific clause that will say, we don't cover anything that is transgender-related. Even though I could get a doctor to say that something is medically necessary, my insurance will still deny it because they have that clause. That's what's becoming illegal, and that's really where the big impact for the trans community is in the Affordable Care Act.
Aaron and or Lindsay, what would you say to somebody who says this is such a small group of people, healthcare right now is so difficult to get, it's so expensive, maybe it should not be part of the Affordable Care Act?
So I would say, what kind of country is that that doesn't want to take care of their most marginalized group of people?
I think the biggest issue here is that we must champion choices in healthcare above all else. And I think individuals' choice to have autonomy over their physicality is the issue at stake here and something that we need to protect.
How do you bring yourself to seek out this particular kind of health care? I mean, is it a brave act just to seek it out to begin with?
Yeah. So for a lot of trans people, one of the first steps in transitioning is actually speaking to a medical provider about those options. Coming out as trans is a very different experience than coming out as lesbian or gay.
Why?
Because it has a medical component to it in the transition. So like if you're coming out as gay or something like that, you're not medicated for it. But if you're transitioning as a transgender individual, you are. You're getting hormone replacement therapy. You're going through the process of medically transitioning your gender. And that's something that is really unique to the trans community. That's why there's such a need for appropriate health care within the trans community, because it is something that is necessary for this community to actually go about living their lives in healthy and productive ways. So I can speak to like my own personal experience, but as a trans person, when I was younger, dealing with the conflict that was being generated between my own internal gender and what I was being forced into by society created such despair within my own life. So I was struggling with depression, with drug use, all of these things, and it was coming from this deep-seated issue with my gender identity. By being able to actually address that, I've been able to move beyond all of those things and become a normal, healthy, productive member of society. But it was through transition. So when faced with a choice between living in depression, living in despair, or actually living my life the way that I want to live my life, it wasn't really an act of bravery. It was something I had to do.
The pressure put upon everyone in society to fit into a sex-designated box, either the hyper-feminine or the hyper-masculine ideals in our society, it's painful for everyone. And once you make it okay for a little girl to have a more masculine personality or be bossy, young girls are told that they're bossy and they need to be more submissive. And that's messages that they're getting from a really young age. And once you make it okay for everyone to be who they are, you make it okay for, a 5 or 6 year old girl to come out as a trans little boy. You make all of these things okay for people to really express themselves how they are in a supportive environment, and you get rid of all of the problems in the middle that are related to body image, that are related to all of these other insecurities trying to be some ideal that no one can meet.
Can a 5 or 6 year old know which way he or she is?
Absolutely, a 5 or 6 year old can know who they are. I knew who I wasn't for. One of my first memories is wanting to be a girl. And that stayed with me throughout my entire life. And then when I come out at 20, everyone tells me it's a phase. Well, at that point, I'd been knowing for 16 years. Here I am 10 years later, and I'm still going. And these days, there are kids coming out and transitioning in preschool. And that's considered very young. And it's getting younger and younger and younger. But, I mean, if you talk to any parent, they're going to tell you that their child knew who they were from the time that they started walking.
Quick couple of questions, very personal, if you don't want to answer them.
Go for it.
I don't know if you're tight with your family, your parents, A, how did they handle it? And are you attracted to men or women, or is it more ambiguous than that? And how do you find a partner?
Those are three great questions. with my own family. So I was raised in a very strict Mormon household, which didn't go over well when I wanted to transition. And it's still rocky. So, you know, we're working on it 10 years later. I do have family members who support me and love me for who I am. But, you know, 10 years later, I'm still trying to work with my parents on basic things like pronouns and using my correct name and you know, just 101 stuff. As far as sexual orientation goes, I mean, that's such a different thing than gender identity. Just because a man is attracted to other men, that doesn't mean that he wants to be a woman. So just because I want to be a woman doesn't mean I have to be attracted to men or women or things like that. So there's often the desire to bring the two together, but they're completely separate entities. And then as far as dating and things like that, you know, that's such a complicated topic within the trans community. I mean, if you talk about not only where are you going to find somebody who's okay with dating somebody who might be trans or who has a history of being trans, how do you disclose your trans status? At what point do you disclose your trans status? These are all very personal decisions that a person has to make. And so, you know, a lot of people turn to the internet because it's really easy to sort of put it out there like, hey, look, I'm trans. And if you want to date me, then that's great. And people can see it right off the bat. It's a lot harder meeting people in person, like at a bar or at an event or something like that.
Without putting yourself at serious risk.
Yeah, that's true. And also a lot of times, like, people don't know. So, like, when I'm walking around on the street or if somebody approaches me at a bar, like, they don't know I'm trans. They can't tell if they're just, like, walking around. You know, so at some point I have to tell them. You know, that can go either way. Sometimes it goes great. Sometimes I've had really negative reactions as well. In the U.S., trans women specifically have one of the highest murder rates of any population in the country. There's homophobia, there's transphobia out there. A lot of it has to do with disclosure, you know, people finding out that you're trans when you're not out about being trans and them feeling betrayed and wanting to lash out and attack you.
Are you typically attracted more to men or women?
So if I were to speak from my own personal experience, it's funny because it's changed. Before transition, I thought, you know, I must be gay because I didn't know what trans was. I didn't know that was possible, but I knew I wanted to be a woman. I felt like a woman, so I figured I must be gay. I must be attracted to men. And I tried that out as a man dating men, and I was like, no, this is like, I am not gay. So I assumed I was into women. And then living as a woman, being socialized as a woman, hormones, all these different things, you know, at some point, a couple years in, I started like seeing guys on the street and being like, oh, you know, he's cute. And so it's been sort of a big, giant gray area for me. So I would say both at this point. Like, to me, gender doesn't matter.
It sounds exhausting.
It's a lot of possibilities.
Aaron Armstrong and Blue Mountain Clinic's Lindsay Burke participated in last week's Gender Expansion Project in Missoula.
And now for tonight's forecast. West of the Continental Divide tonight should be mostly cloudy with lows 15 to 22 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with rain and snow likely and highs in the 40s. Central Montana, there is a high wind warning in effect from midnight tonight to 9 p.m. Thursday for the Rocky Mountain Front. Tonight, expect increasing cloud cover, lows 25 to 30 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and slight chance of rain in the afternoon with highs in the 40 to 50 degrees. And wind gusts up to 65 miles per hour near the Rocky Mountain Front. Southwest Montana tonight, expect increasing cloud cover and lows 20 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and highs 40 to 45 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Susan Kohler.
Good evening. I'm Susan Kohler, CEO of Missoula Aging Services, the area agency on aging for Missoula and Ravalli counties. Tonight, I want to share some information about Alzheimer's disease, which I learned at the UM Geriatric Education Center's conference in mid-October. But first, I'd like to say hats off to the GEC for providing this free, top-notch conference broadcast to 25 sites in Montana. What I share are snippets from a variety of the excellent speakers who discuss the latest research on treatments and the interrelationship that lifestyle risk factors and genetic influences have on the development of Alzheimer's. Today, Alzheimer's affects 13% of the population who are 65 or older. Every 68 seconds, someone develops this disease. Currently, no cure exists, and medication has only marginally helped slow its progression. By the year 2050, 22% of the population will be affected, at the cost of $1.2 trillion to provide care. If that doesn't grab your attention, nothing will. Alzheimer's disease is a public health crisis. Despite our country's progress in decreasing the number of people who die from heart disease, breast and prostate cancer, the number of people with Alzheimer's continues to rise. Only the UK, Sweden, and Denmark have seen a 30% drop in Alzheimer's. Without the benefit of detailed study, speculation is that the decrease is due to the benefits of primary preventative care for all citizens, including education about the effects of smoking, better diets, and higher education. Whether such a dramatic drop in cases of Alzheimer's could occur in the U.S. is unknown, especially considering our much higher rate of obesity. But obviously, something is working in those countries. I came to the conference wondering if there is a clear way of knowing what causes this degenerative disease, and if so, what can I and others do to prevent it? Are genetics and family history the primary risk factors, or are there modifiable factors that we can control? What I learned is that genetic disposition is part of the story. If one or more family members have had Alzheimer's, or if you carry the gene E4, you have a 20 to 30% chance of developing it. Yet people with no genetic disposition get Alzheimer's too. In these cases, lifestyle practices appear to be the key risk factors. These include smoking, psychological stress, chemical exposure, and the recently highlighted effects of concussions and traumatic brain injuries. The good news is that the lifestyle factors which increase the risk of developing Alzheimer's are modifiable. Even those who are at higher risk due to the genetics can delay the onset by adopting healthy living habits. Many of these interventions are the same basic strategies used for preventing cardiovascular diseases, including good nutrition, keeping your weight down, education, medication, aerobic and resistant exercises. Several speakers spoke about red wine consumption as a possible way to reduce risk for those without the genetic predisposition to Alzheimer's. This is because red wine contains the powerful antioxidant resveratrol. So why hasn't the focus been on consuming non-alcoholic antioxidants loaded with resveratrol, like blueberries? Apparently, it's because one would need to ingest 29 pounds of blueberries to equal the effect of drinking two glasses of red wine. Obviously, more study is needed to find alternative ways to reap the benefits of resveratrol. Consuming alcohol brings its own issues. Among them, its high level of toxicity on the brain. Other speakers address the treatment of Alzheimer's patients who are agitated and exhibiting behavioral issues. The first line of treatment is often with antipsychotics, which tend to sedate a person. Promising research now shows that the drug prazosin is also effective, but without the sedative effects. Working with the causes of behavioral rather than immediately medicating may also help curtail the widespread misuse of medication, a problem in facilities which care for people with Alzheimer's. At the end of a full day of information, a panel of caregivers, all spouses of persons with Alzheimer's, brought it down to the reality of those who are affected by the dreadful disease. These brave individuals shared their heart-wrenching stories of the overwhelming financial and emotional toll which caregivers endure. Their stories tied it all together and convinced me that this disease is indeed a public health crisis needing more attention. I left humbled and motivated to advocate for more research toward preventing and curing Alzheimer's. You can learn more about the information shared at the conference by going to my commentary online at mtpr.org, and you'll find the link there. This is Susan Kohler, CEO of Missoula Aging Services, and as always, thanks for listening.
Susan Kohler is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne.
And I'm Madeline Beck. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.